You're listening to TIP.
On today's episode, we are exploring the evolution of quant investing with Dr. Jonathan Briggs. Jonathan holds a PhD in mechanical engineering and applied mechanics from UPenn and has had a long career of researching and developing investing techniques for pension funds such as CPP Investment Board. He is now the CIO of his own fund, Delphia, where they are implementing techniques developed from his research. In this episode, we discuss the basics of quant investing, the commoditization of the approach and what has led to a quote-unquote quant winter, how size and scale applies to the strategies, how machine learning is playing a bigger role in the quant approach, the economic framework Jonathan has devised after decades of research, and much, much more. This was a very interesting look into the Moneyball approach of investing. Does it invalidate fundamentals? Let's find out in this discussion with the very thoughtful Dr. Jonathan Briggs.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
Welcome to The Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Trey Lockerbie, and today I am so excited to have on the show Dr. Jonathan Briggs. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Doctor, not a real doctor, though.
If you got a PhD, you're a doctor to me, you know?
Fair enough.
Speaking of which, you've had an incredible career, and maybe talk to us about that PhD and then how you found your way into finance and how you've started to develop the approach you have today. So let's start all the way back and go from there.
Go to the origin story. Huh? So that's the PhD is, I was interested in applied math engineering. So that was my first love, which was obviously why you go into a graduate program to begin with. And in particular, I was focusing on something called control theory, which is a set of theories about how you manage to make systems do what you want them to do. So how do you make an aircraft behave the way you want it to do? How do you make SpaceX, you know, land vertically on a small ship? So that's all control theory, or Tesla, how it self-drives. So that was my passion. There was certainly, obviously, life never goes in one particular direction. You never ended up in the spot you thought you would. And that was true with me. And so for personal reasons, we had to move close to my wife's family after I graduated. And that turned out to be San Francisco, California. And while I was there, I just basically had to look for a job. So any plans of going on into academia put by the wayside, and I had to find someplace to use my talents and get paid effectively. So when I showed up in San Francisco, there were only certain numbers of places that were hiring. Remember, it was pretty close to the dot-com bubble. So tech really wasn't the place to go. And it turned out that finance was hiring. In particular, Charles Schwab was looking to hire folks with a background similar to mine to help them build what ostensibly turned out to be a robo-advisor. And so folks like myself can certainly help with some of the applied math that goes into building such things. Funny story is, I don't think it was a success early days, but you know, it was a bit before its time, but has, I think, had some success going forward. But the person who hired me was looking specifically for somebody with a PhD and with an applied math background. And that was my first entry point into actual finance, where I learned about stocks and bonds, which I had no exposure to up until that point. Literally, I'd never invested a penny in my life. And there was one person in particular at Schwab by the name of Jim Peterson, who, he's still there. He's actually the CIO of Charles Schwab Investment Advisory, a great human being. He took me under his wing and started to teach me about, you know, the Journal of Finance and quantitative investing. So it included things like Fama French and Momentum and things like that. And so that was my first introduction. I spent about 4 years at Schwab, as I said, helping to build this robo-advisory. I got exposed to their Schwab equity ratings. Some of you may have seen that. It was pretty clear to me that it was time to move on. And I would say the giant in the industry at that time was out of San Francisco. It was a place called Barclays Global Investors. They had pioneered the quantitative investing process, literally written the book on it. But there's a book by Gerald and Kahn, who are Barclays Global Investors, we can talk about at some point perhaps. And primarily, they built an incredible business off of quantitative equity world, which was, they had basically gathered a ton of assets, would continue to gather assets over the next 6 years while I was there, and really won accolades for their performance over that period of time using a quantitative approach. So to me, I think was formative. That was like going and getting my next degree, so to speak, in quantitative asset management. And I worked with some of the brightest minds at the time in that space, Richard Grenold, Ron Kahn, Mark Britton-Jones, Maury Wakeit, Ken Kroner. These are all sort of names that became pinnacle of their career in quantitative investing until BlackRock acquired them in 2010. And My understanding was BlackRock really was interested in the iShares business, which BGI had built along the side of its active investing strategies. And it just turned out, I think, to not be a place for me. Just, you know, it was a different culture, different utility function for the organization at that point. And so I wasn't the only one. There was a natural sort of a diaspora, I think, from BGI out of San Francisco at that point. So a recruiter called me out of the middle of nowhere. He's an interesting human being. He basically called me up and he said, "Hey, I know what we made last year. I know your wife's name, your daughter's name. I know everything about you. There's this place called CPPIB that's recruiting a lot of talented folks." And I hung up on him, literally. I thought, this guy is a stalker. How could you possibly know this?
Very odd approach.
Very odd approach. But what was hilarious is that he said, "Okay, trust me, go walk across the aisle to the head of the global macro team and go ask him about me. Ask him, do you know Bob Shainite?" And I was like, so when I talked to him, this is Ken Croner at the time. He said, "Oh yeah, he's a great guy. He helped BGI build from the ground up." So he ended up turning out to be legit, thank God. And yeah, so CPPIB was essentially, which is the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board, was recruiting a bunch of talented folks across the world and bringing them on board in Canada to help build their investments internally. And then such began the journey. I started on the global macro team, which is a style of investing that essentially is betting economy versus economy through the various instruments. Bridgewater Associates is sort of, I think, the pinnacle of global macro investing. Most folks have probably heard of them. So I spent a few years working on the macro team. There were some changes going on the equity side. And at some point, they reached out and asked me and said, "Hey, why don't you come be the head of the quant equity research team?" That was the beginning of my equity experience as a researcher in terms of actually doing what I would call forecasting of expected returns. That was a journey that was about 8 years long.
Talk to us about that pension experience, because as we were kind of discussing beforehand, they did a good job forecasting this gap, this demographic gap with the baby boomer generation and managing that quite well. So I'm wondering if that is an isolated event, if the US pensions have followed suit, or if this is an anomaly as far as their strategy and execution.
I'm not a pension consultant, so I don't really know the health of the average pension system in the world, but there are certain countries which have had the foresight to look ahead and say, you know, look, we have a demographic problem. We have a younger generation, which isn't as large. We have a lot of excess requirements going forward for health and benefits. And so they set up a process to essentially do a wealth transfer, intergenerational wealth transfer to take care of, you know, the elder generation and their retirement. And CPPIB was certainly one of those, incredibly insightful and long thinking, long range thinking in that regard. And have collected assets over the last, well, I don't know, 15, 20 years to address that. And they're incredibly solid, you know, actuarially, I think they're well provisioned for the next 75 years. And they take those assets that they gather and they reinvest them on behalf of the people of Canada to further the returns as much as possible. And, you know, I think, you know, something like Norway, I think, has done something very similar to some Middle Eastern countries. It's a remarkable decision to make by any society to invest that kind of energy to do that.
So as I understand it, CPPIB has something like $600 billion they're managing. And it's understandable at that size that you are essentially, I mean, forced into finding systematic ways to invest, right? Because it's just the sheer size of it. So you can understand this effort to develop systematic investing and that approach. So I know we're going to get into that. I'd like to start with some pretty basic questions around systematic investing, or quant investing for shorthand. Talk to us about what defines, say, a quality factor versus a value factor versus something like a momentum factor. And let's go from there.
Yeah. In fact, when people talk about quantitative investing, they basically lean into this concept of value, quality, momentum, sort of the pillars. In fact, you know, AQR, which is now one of the preeminent quantitative investing shops, their founders published a bunch of articles related in the Journal of Finance, et cetera, on these types of behavioral ideas. But they go back quite, not behavioral, but these types of exposure ideas. And they go back quite far in time. So Fama French were the original, you know, creators of the ideas of these broad cross-sectional exposures that explain returns. And what I mean by that is, what they do is they take a group of companies, which, you know, maybe it's the S&P 500 or the Russell 3000. And what they'll do is they'll essentially create a characteristic, which could be a ratio of, or some quantity that basically describes something about a company. They then take these and they rank them across the entire set of companies that they're interested in looking at. So again, the S&P 500, the Russell 3000. And then these then describe a portfolio. So it's a process of transforming these quantities into a portfolio, which is very straightforward. And then they backtest it or they run it live. Now, it turns out that these three categories, they're very, you know, they become, they're not a single factor, but they represent a bucket of factors. Value is this idea that, like, free cash flow to price. So this idea that there's a certain amount of free cash flow a company has, and if the price is very high, then that's less attractive than a company that has high free cash flow. The price is very low. So fairly intuitive. And you can rank all the companies of interest in that context. So that's a value factor. This idea that something over price is a value factor. Quality is essentially a measure of profitability, for instance, so gross profits to total assets. Again, it's a ratio to kind of normalize to the size of a company. But again, you can rank, the more gross profits compared to the total assets you have, obviously the better the company you think it will be. And so you can rank on these things. Momentum is actually very different. It's basically saying, if I look at a particular company and I see the trend in its returns over the last year or 6 months or however long you want to look for that trend, it again indicates to you that trend should continue. That's the underlying thesis. So then you can rank companies based on these trends. Now, the idea is then you have these three factors, these three buckets that all sort of look alike in terms of within a bucket. And you can create portfolios of each of these and then add them all together. So you're essentially averaging across all of these, what we call characteristics. So value, quality, momentum are characteristics that you can average across. Now, you can be bespoke in the amount of weight you put to each one of these. And that, of course, is part of this, the secret sauce for some quantitative investors. But in the end, you end up with an aggregate portfolio. So everything gets squished together and you have an aggregate view. And this then gives you, the ones with the highest ranking is the one you want to go long. The ones with the lowest ranking are the ones you want to go short. And so this is a quantitative, I would say a very typical or traditional quantitative investment strategy. You can use it in equities, you can use it in macro, you can use it in credit.
And talk to us a little bit about this idea of smart beta. Is this encapsulated in what you just described? Or is this a whole other level?
So what happened there was, this is a fascinating story. It's the evolution of quant in some ways, maybe not for the better. But so BGI and AQR and places like this were building these factor portfolios and adding, you know, using them for investing. But just in the way I described them to you, I think it should become clear that they're not so sophisticated that they can't remember them and walk out the door and go to some other place and reconstruct them. So there's this diffusion process where quantitative ideas became fairly well known in the investment industry. In fact, you know, people published articles about them, obviously, in the Journal of Finance. They made books about them. So what happened was that providers of a product sort of took away from the hedge fund world, the quantitative hedge fund world, and said, well, look, I can just repackage these very same things and sell them back to whoever wants them, whether it's retail, whether it's institutions, at a very, very cheap price. Because again, the process of building this is very, very systematic. You can have a computer do most of the work. They rebranded this smart beta. So they took something which was considered proprietary and exceptional and alpha, which is this idea of being able to beat expected returns with it, comes back and says, okay, well, now this is something very commoditized. I can sell it to everyone. And this became the smart beta revolution where everyone is buying exposures to things, whether it's price earnings, free cash flow price, whether it's momentum, whether it's quality factors. The smart beta just became a way to sort of justify that this thing exists in the context of a particular type of regression framework. And quants like to talk about things in regression frameworks. So it was just a natural way to start, you know, marketing the product. I think it's had, you know, I think it's had some fairly dramatic effects on people's view of quantitative investing because it looks very commoditized at this point. In fact, in the process of sort of talking about what I do to other institutional investors, one particular very smart investor came back and said, here's how I view smart beta lifecycle. Do you have a second? I could read it to you. It's absolutely hilarious.
Let's go in.
Okay, so there's 15 steps. I know it sounds like a lot, but it'll go quick. One thing I want to point out is quants basically talk about backtests, which is this idea that I could simulate an investment strategy and show you the returns that would have had, and you should feel very comfortable then that this thing will perform like that in the future, which of course, everyone should know that that's probably not the way it's going to play out. But instead, the backtesting is part of the whole process of quantitative investing. So step one, launch product with amazing backtest. Okay, looks great. Two, experience underperformance. Okay, terrible. Three, show clients that similar underperformance has shown up in the backtest. So it's just statistical noise. Four, experience more underperformance. Five, show clients that the level of underperformance has never appeared in the backtest, so it's sure to revert. Six, experience more underperformance. Seven, publish a paper. This is critical because only smart people can publish papers, and smart people are good at investing. Eight, experience more underperformance. Nine, tell clients that the strategy requires patience and that the backtest results are more indicative of the future than the live results actually are. 10, experience more underperformance. 11, claim that smart beta providers as a whole have overpromised, but that you are absolved of any such wrongdoing because you are criticizing everybody else yourself. 12, experience more underperformance. 13, tell clients that you are a good diversifier since you are underperforming while others are outperforming. 14, experience some outperformance, but not nearly enough to make up for inception to date underperformance. Declare victory. That's sort of the view now of the allocators to quantitative investing.
Now, is that one of the reasons we're seeing what I've heard you call a quant winter that started as of, 2018 or so?
Yes, this is exactly right. This is the result of investors who put money into quantitative strategies, particularly institutional investors, are quite frustrated. So 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, this idea of value, quantum momentum, just didn't perform well. And it was broad-based across most of the quantitative investing universe.
And talk to us a little bit more about the commoditization, because what is needed for that to revert? Some new innovation, I suppose, that would need to come and disrupt the market, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So actually, this was the choice that faced me on the research side of things. I said, I looked at this and I said, look, Goldman Sachs has shown up at my door, offered to sell me this thing. And this is prior to 2017. So in expectation, something this commoditized and other providers too, whether it's Vanguard, for instance. So should I expect outperformance based on these things? And I made the decision that no, I don't think that this is likely to continue the performance we've had in the past. We need to do something different. And then to do something different, you obviously have to invest time, energy, and resources, which is never an easy decision and an ongoing concern, particularly of an asset manager.
So you dug into some research. I'm curious what you found when you were assessing people like Buffett, Klarman, Soros, et cetera. You've written about this underlying theme that you found that came from studying those three in particular. So I'm curious, what was the thread that kind of, that kind of tied those three together?
The idea was you had successful investors. These were folks who had a long track record, had shown resiliency across many market conditions or market cycles. So the question really was, from the quantitative perspective, what we've been told always or intuited ourselves or argued amongst ourselves was that folks like these shouldn't be successful by definition. Why? Because they don't have massively diversified portfolios. I mean, they don't have 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 stocks in their portfolios. They're actually very focused on understanding companies at a very detailed level, but at a company level. They're not thinking about these things as, if I back tested this idea, would it give me a great result? They're really saying, hey, this is a company. This has a purpose. It exists to do something. And is it a good thing? And that can be applied to macro as well. This doesn't have to be just company, but applied to credit, can be applied to currencies, whatever it is, you can really sort of dig in, try to understand what it is the real economy is doing, and then trying to understand what investors think about it. And so that was as it became more and more evident to me that what we had was commoditized on the quant side, it became more and more evident to me, as I said, that in the fundamental space, there's a lot of rich understanding of what markets should be doing or could be doing or might be doing. And as a quant, you've kind of ignored that channel, right? You may have a superficial interest in it. So for me, it was, if we're going to look someplace new, there's this whole body of work, which we've disregarded because it isn't statistically interesting. What is it? We have some shining examples of folks who outperformed the markets for a long time. We should learn something. And that was, it's a bit of humble pie, right? It's basically being able to say, hey, I've invested, whether it's the applied math background of the PhD plus all the statistical analysis we did, Marcus will step back and maybe somebody else can teach you something new. And that was really provocative for us and for myself.
What in your experience did you see as sort of the shortcomings of that quantitative approach? Is it that obviously it's needed for the scale we talked about in the pension arena, but is it applicable to use that same approach when you have a much smaller account? Does it break down anywhere along the way?
The concept of quantitative investing, which is this idea that your returns or your risk-adjusted returns are a product of two things. One is the skill you have, which is intuitive to everybody, multiplied times the breadth or the number of attempts you have to express that skill. So think about it as gambling. If you can count cards, you go to Vegas, you get thrown out of the casino probably, but let's assume you don't get thrown out. You can count cards and you sit at a table and you play blackjack, single deck blackjack. The advantage conferred upon you by counting cards is small. It's not huge. And so to really sort of reap the rewards of that ability to count, you have to sit at the table and play many, many, many hands. And so that's a perfect example of the combination of skill, which you have to beat the house, plus the number of times you can make those bets. it's kind of like gravity. Maybe you don't believe in it, but it's true. It exists. It's statistically closest thing to a proof you can do. And so, particularly in investing. So that's a long way to say that that property of investing skill times the number of bets you make is true for anyone. Obviously, the trade-off between skill and the number of bets you make can be made, which is why we see fundamental investors taking very few bets, but they potentially have very high skill. Whereas potentially quantitative investors have lower skill, but have many more bets. So you can kind of make up for those two things. If you think about it, like somebody trying to do this on their own, that number becomes really problematic. So the number of bets you have to make becomes almost unmanageable. If you're managing a portfolio with 10,000 securities in it, it's almost impossible for an individual to do or do well.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Our friends at Corient provide wealth management services centered around you. Corient's goal is to exceed your expectations and simplify your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. They are one of the largest integrated fee-only U.S. registered investment advisors, and Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. The teams at Corient put the collective power of their expertise into building you the custom wealth, investment, and family office solutions that can help you reach your holistic financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, speak with an advisor today at Corient.com. That's spelled Corient.com. That's Corient.com. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com.
All right, back to the show.
Now, my understanding is, or at least originally, was around this idea of quant solving for the psychology aspect of investing, right? Kind of taking the human out of the equation, because as humans and our biases, we're prone to make so many mistakes and really shoot ourselves in the foot, so to speak, right? When it comes to investing. So, how does the quant approach solve that exactly if you're trading so often, as you kind of mentioned? Obviously, there's trigger points that you're being alerted on to get out of a position at certain points. So talk to us a little bit about what that looks like.
There's a bunch of interesting points you brought up. The one is, how do quants trade? And then the other thing is the biases when you are trading. How do you, the second judging, the triple judging, the quadruple, looking back, maximizing your regret. So yes, indeed, the systematic process, which is tied to this idea of a backtest, is to try and remove the biases. So you create a thesis, and that thesis you believe in, and make empirical evidence around it being properly vetted and properly tested. So like a scientific method almost. Then when you let it go, the impetus to interfere with that is, it's very low. So there's a big barrier to jumping in to try to overcome that. And so that prevents you from introducing your own biases. So certainly in your research, you could have introduced your own bias, which happens a lot, by the way, even in quantitative space. But getting the process moving, does the thesis is to try and remove that effect. And also the idea that you can test things in time and geography. So you test an idea in Japan, test it in the US, Canada, Australia, emerging markets, and you test it through multiple cycles or macro cycles. So that helps you build up a body of evidence that whatever you're doing probably doesn't have as much bias in it as you might have if you were just to do it off the side of your desk, off the top of your head. Now, that's the idea that, it can introduce some firewalls to the bias problem. But quants don't necessarily have to trade quickly. So when I said that we made lots of bets, there are two ways to make lots of bets. One is to make lots of bets across many stocks, and one is to make lots of bets through time. So high-frequency traders might trade three stocks, but do it every millisecond. So that's a lot of bets. Right? As long as their bets are independent of each other, then that's a great way to bring into that idea of breadth. But there's another set of quants, like myself and Barclays Global Investors and AQR, who are not really looking for speed. They're looking for understanding a thesis that says I can make not many bets in time, not too many bets in time, but a lot of bets across names. When I say cross-section, it's the company dimension or the time dimension. So the cross-section is the company dimension. Time dimension is a whole different game. And it turns out that you want to use as much of both as you can to increase the statistical significance. But I want to caution people not to think of this quants as fast trading all the time. That's certainly like the flash boys and things like that became very popular and are easy to understand that speed is an advantage. But I would flip you over towards the fundamental space, which says speed isn't the only advantage, but being able to predict is another advantage. And fundamental investors do that all day, every day. And so perhaps a mix of those two ideas, which AQR and BGI sort of extended into, and I think that we extended further in that direction, is can you make things that are more forward-looking, more prognostication to help you with, and then use that in a less speed, but more future-looking. The primary reason you want to do that is because high-frequency trading has an impact on markets that erodes whatever returns because it's just you're paying costs as you trade more and more and more. And markets are smart. As you trade fast and you trade more and you trade with more dollars, more and more people are attracted to that behavior and front-running. So it becomes a sort of endless, sort of like a fruitless exercise to try to trade too fast because then you erode all the returns that you may have had by understanding something better. So if you really want scale, if you really want to trade a lot of assets, a lot of dollars, and this is why institutional investors are attracted to these ideas, is that you want to trade slower and you want to hold for longer. And then that reduces your frictions or your transaction costs. So quants have traditionally never really gone out as far into the future as fundamental investors. Fundamental investors were really king of, like Buffett. I mean, I don't know. Maybe he's looking out 10 years, maybe 7 years, 5 years. But they're really pushing the boundaries of forecasting it into the future. And quants have not done that to date. You know, these ideas of quality, value, momentum, you're looking at about a three-month horizon, maybe a little bit longer with some value factors, maybe 6 or 7, maybe 8 months out. So they've really left behind this whole idea of long horizon forecasting. And I would argue that actually quite deeply that quants are not forecasting in the strong sense that a fundamental investor is doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And what's kind of coming to my mind is especially for retail investors, understanding these three factor approaches and how they integrate together potentially. So if you wanted to build a portfolio with them, I'm wondering if any of the factors tend to overlap or if they're kind of all in their own island. So for example, value and momentum almost seem to be opposites, right? Because you think of earlier companies like Facebook, Amazon, when they weren't generating any earnings, you could easily look at that on a value factor basis and say, well, this is a terrible investment, right? There's no earnings. Whereas, you know, if you were a momentum trader, you would have done quite well. So, and value has been underperforming for a very long time. So obviously, if you're putting a packaging a portfolio together, probably want some exposure to each one. I'm not looking for financial advice, but I'm curious, is that a common approach even on the institutional side where they're trying to put a certain allocation towards these different buckets?
So this is true even in our framework, which again deviates from quality by momentum. But to your point, that's exactly right. So this is diversification. Diversification is the number of stocks, but it's also the number of ideas. So momentum is as an idea, or value is an idea, or quality is an idea. You want them, ideally, what you'd like them to have is different return signatures through time. And so that what that allows you to do is build a portfolio which is robust across different regimes, potentially. And so that's exactly what they're looking for. So diversification across factors is part of the lexicon for quant investing.
All right. So you've done all this research for many years now, and you've developed this economic framework that I'd love for you to kind of lay out for our audience and talk to us about how the elements of quality, value, and momentum kind of evolve from here.
So as I said, the ideas behind quality and value momentum, my expectations on them had paled a bit. And I've also mentioned the fundamental investing world seemed like a very fruitful direction to go and look and learn from. And so that's That's exactly what myself and my, you know, my team, we did. We basically took a pause at the time and we sat back and we said, let's try to re-examine some first principles, what it is that we actually believe that markets are doing. And let's see if that ends up back at quality value momentum again, which is fine, in which case we come full circle. Or perhaps we end up in a different place. And luckily, I had a thought partner in this, his incredible human being, Frank Araci. He's now the Senior Managing Director of Global Equities, Fundamental Equities for CPPIB. I've known him for 12 years almost now. And he and I and my team at the time, we sat down and we started to think about, okay, first principle, what do we believe in? Well, first of all, what we said was, you know, markets are forward-looking. So price is a function of things expected in the future. They're not, it's not a function of things looking backwards, it's a thing looking forward. Of course, that expectation of some futures is predicated on all the information available to you now. So that includes sunspots, that includes how many people drive in the morning, it also includes everything. So it's a very general statement, but it's quite powerful. So it allows you to sort of ask other questions like, okay, well, if prices are very forward-looking, and prices change through time, then can I say something about the change in price? So it turns out you can. You can do some very simple manipulation of that idea and you combine some things together. And this gets a little bit on the mathy side, but what pops out is that, well, okay, changes in price, which are really returns, are described by some sort of attention based on surprise. So, and what I mean by surprise is I expected, markets expected something in the future, they got something else, and then there's a correction. So this idea that markets are forward-looking and they react to revealed information and the size of that reaction is based on the attention being paid to it. Again, these are very general concepts, but that's a really key part. So markets are always looking forward, looking to expect something, and then they have to react when that something shows up and it's different than what they expected. The next piece is, okay, well, how are we going to discover what those things are that markets are expecting? We want something that makes markets move a lot. I mean, big returns are available to you. We want it to move frequently, which is this idea of breadth. So we want many bets at the game. And we certainly don't want the game to go away, whatever it is that we're looking at. We don't want it to end in 3 years or 5 years. We want this thing, whatever this surprise thing is, we want it to go on forever. And the final piece was, well, capital markets aren't their casino. You know, capital markets are there to allocate capital. This is the Benjamin Graham, you know, the voting machine, weighing machine, right? So this, the short horizon, sure, maybe there's a voting component, but in the long horizon, capital markets are there to allocate capital efficiently. That was the foundation. So it's this idea of surprise, which is based on expectations. So what do markets expect? Can you understand that? This rearrangement once markets are surprised, this idea of surprise has to be worth the pursuit. And then the idea that, well, okay, let's look at fundamentals and let's look at it through the lens of an empirical investor. So let's think about this. Let's design a set of experiments to test all of these. And that's really what we did. We basically spent about a year and a half thinking about these ideas and testing them. The test is interesting. So bear with me for a second. So if you look at how fundamental investors invest, so you can go online, you can say, you know, look at KPIs, for instance. That's kind of like the language of a fundamental investor, KPIs. So KPIs tell fundamental investors a lot about the state of a company, you know, what it's likely to do in the future. You can buy KPI libraries, by the way, there are thousands of them, thousands. And so assume you take all of those KPIs and you say, well, I'm going to be the perfect fundamental investor. I'm going to assume that I can predict KPIs perfectly at any horizon, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. Then I'm going to take those predictions and I'm going to put them in a backtest framework. I'm going to basically be like a quant. I'm going to create a quant portfolio out of these ideas and I'm going to run a backtest and see what happens. See if any of these ideas create really lucrative portfolios. Interestingly enough, most of those ideas don't produce lucrative portfolios. Before you go too far down that rabbit hole and say, well, you know, that's absurd. But as a quant, we were like, oh, of course, we knew this. You know, fundamental investors don't know anything. So of course, this is obvious. And I'll come back to that because that's actually quite arrogant. And we had to eat crow on that. But what we did find was that various measures of cash flow across different horizons were incredibly powerful, meaning if you could predict these cash flowy type variables in a portfolio context, you almost achieve perfect foresight on returns themselves, which is a remarkable concept. It means that, oh my goodness, maybe fundamentals, cash flow fundamentals and returns are tightly coupled together, are tied together. I don't want to say causally linked because that sets up a whole argument about specific mathematical definitions of causality. But let's just say for the sake of argument, there's a causal linkage between these cash flow growth of cash flow through time and returns. there's a horizon component to this. In the short horizon, not so much. Right? That tide of returns in a one-month horizon is not so strong. That tide of returns at a three-year horizon is almost 90%. So you're really starting to see this interesting interplay between, again, the Benjamin Graham, the voting versus weighing, that in the long horizon, these growths of cash flows really describe a causal relationship that markets are weighing on constantly. In the short horizon, there's a bunch of other stuff going on that don't necessarily, at least in the variables we looked at, explain returns. So this is remarkable. So the question to ask then is, set aside quality, value, momentum for a moment, which have none of that forecasting power at all, like not even close to that. These other things, wow, I mean, we couldn't have accidentally found these because they're so close to returns themselves. They have to be statistically significant. There's no human bias that could have introduced that. And by the way, it works, again, globally across all time. So then, these seem like really rich things to understand. So kudos to fundamental investors. They're really thinking of discounted cash flow models. I think that's the right thing to do. But again, all these KPIs are useless. So the question was, as a quant, can we predict these things? And this makes all the difference, right? So now we lean into the predicting realm of things. And how do we do prediction? Which opened up a whole new world for us. So then, right? Well, what do you use to predict? You have tools, right? So linear regression is one tool. But everyone listening to your podcast has heard of the AI revolution. So linear regressions are linear, meaning they're very simple relationships that they can capture. Machine learning and AI capture very, very complicated relationships. The problem is with machine learning and AI is that it requires a lot of data to help sort of organize themselves to pick out complicated relationships. The worst thing you can do is to give very little data to a machine learning algorithm and tell it to figure stuff out, because it'll figure out relationships that aren't really true. We call this overfitting. The problem we found was in trying to forecast returns with machine learning, which has been done by many, many organizations. I think some had some success. I think very few have had success. Is that the complexity of returns themselves don't lend themselves to scarce amounts of data. So you really are operating at a dangerous end of the deep end of the, like a dangerous part of the swimming. I don't know if that's a real expression, probably mixing my metaphors there. It's a dangerous part of the ocean, because you have this thing which is very dynamic. Returns are very dynamic, and you have this very limited pool of observations to train your machine, your nonlinear machine learning algorithm on to try to predict returns. And so this creates a problem, right? So if you start to use this technology, it's kind of like giving somebody who's untrained a weapon to somebody who's untrained. You know, it's quite dangerous. So what's happened is this: there's been a bunch of managers who tried to use it with disastrous results. So in sample, it looks like, you know, when you try to test, it looks great. When you try it live, it looks terrible. I think one way that has been short-circuited is that in the really high frequency space, again, you go back to lots of observations. Every millisecond is a thing. And I think you've seen some success. You've seen, because the numbers of observations are really, really high, it gives the machine learning something to play with. On the other hand, in the long horizon, when you're talking about 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, there's just not a lot of independent observations. And so the machine learning really struggles to create good forecasts that you would expect to work out of samples. So when you go live. But what we observed was quality, the properties of cash flows is not the same as returns. While those things, remember, we've said seem to be causally linked together, they're a very different beast. They're not being impacted by the speed of human thought. They're being impacted by the speed of human interactions, which is buying and selling and producing goods and services, which is just not as fraught with chaos. And so by structuring a problem where we're trying to predict a fundamental outcome, you basically change the dynamics of the thing you're trying to predict. And I think fundamental investors really knew that. They basically said, look, price is really, really hard. But if we assume this co-integrating relationship between price and fundamentals, let's focus on the fundamentals. And again, we'll think about it in the longer horizon. So absolutely brilliant. We set about to replicate that behavior. Let's do this forecasting exercise. And this thing turns out to be well-behaved. So fundamentals turns out to be well-behaved relative to returns. So we started the march down the machine learning path. You know, we started linear stuff. You know, we slowly increased the amount of degrees of freedom that this thing was allowed to play with. And then we said, okay, we're gonna let the dogs out. We're gonna try machine learning, but again, not completely crazy, because we're saying we're gonna focus it on particular variables related to real economic fundamentals, and that started to work. It's like, oh, this is really interesting. But again, we never achieved anything close to perfect foresight on these variables, on these cash flow type variables. So we really struggled. Okay, how do we get our accuracy up? So okay, we did something interesting here. the returns that we can generate with portfolios like this when we backtest them don't look commercially viable. Like no one would pay for these things. Now what? Okay, let's couple things. One is, first of all, we probably should put really interesting things into the machine learning process. Something we know has value in forecasting the future. And here's where I come back to my eating crow moment. Oh, KPIs might work. Bingo. So now you start putting in KPIs into a forecasting problem for fundamentals. And oh my goodness, all of this fundamental knowledge in the world was not for nothing. I mean, this is a huge compendium of human, you know, intellect. People have spent time denoising business models. They look at business models and they say, let's throw away the insignificant things and look at the significant things. And so fundamental investors have really spent a lifetime understanding how certain variables interact with each other within a certain business model. Once you bring those into the forecasting exercise, you really start to see a lift in the forecasting accuracy. Now, we went back to the fundamental investors that we'd spoken to about this. Of course, they're like, oh yeah, you idiot. I mean, we never said these things had value in forecast earnings. We said KPIs had a lot to say about cash flows, and cash flows have a lot to say about returns. And so as a quant, basically, where was I? I'd basically gone down the yellow brick road and ended up being a complete believer in fundamental investing. And actually, it was this idea of surprise. Remember, I talked about surprise. Well, if you give machine learning a forecasting problem, it's going to spend a lot of its time and energy and budget. I mean, you give it a certain number of variables, a certain number of observations to work with to help calibrate it. It's going to end up giving you a lot of things that are already well known, which is unfortunate, right? It may do a great job, but it's telling you stuff you already knew. So, okay, well, that's not good. Let's add some structure. Surprise is the structure. So you have to understand what markets expect, subtract that from what the outcome will be, which is surprise, and then force the machine learning to focus on the stuff that's not known, which goes back to this idea that surprise is what defines returns. And so, but we did it in this way. It was through a fundamental channel.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, do you ever wonder how investors like Peter Thiel have Roth IRAs worth billions? Many do more than just save a portion of their income, invest it in the stock market, and cross their fingers and hope it grows enough to retire on. The secret is they use something called a self-directed IRA, which has all the tax advantages we love, but with a twist. Instead of being stuck with stocks, bonds, and cookie-cutter options, a self-directed IRA with New Direction Trust Company allows you to invest your retirement savings in what you know and what you're passionate about. From real estate to startups to gold and silver, there are nearly unlimited investment options. You could even finance and set the terms of a loan. You name it, NDTCO will help you fund it. We're not saying you'll be the next Peter Thiel, but we're not saying that either. Because his secrets are now your secrets. Check out New Direction Trust Company and self-directed IRAs today at ndtco.com and unlock the potential of your retirement savings. That's ndtco.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered, and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news, and each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market, so I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
Now, surprises can happen either up or down, right? So what I'm kind of curious about is there's been a lot of surprises, especially in the last couple of years. And, you know, when we had the original COVID market crash, that was obviously a surprise. And then there was a surprise to the upside following thereafter. So how would a machine learning approach have performed through some event like that, both up and down?
So to your point, expectations are not a single beast, right? There's multiple cohorts of investors out there investing in a particular style. And so they have their own expectations. To avoid being stuck with one set of expectations, which can be right or can be wrong, in which case you kind of limited your ability to earn returns if you're always fighting one set of cohorts when another one is actually dominating price. You have to understand the heterogeneous nature of investors. So Bridgewater talks about this a lot as well, but we've internalized these ideas very deeply ourselves, is that even if we take a very simple example, there's a dominant view in the market, which is expressed by the dollars being invested in a particular view. So let's say, Trey, you say sales growth is going to be high for this company. And there's a bunch of people like you, and you all put in a lot of money into that view. Well, if that were the only view in the market, price would shoot up, it would go crazy. But we know there's a set of people who disagree with you in the market, and they'll invest a certain amount of money to disagree with you, and they'll impact price as well. So you end up with this equilibrium state, which gets created in price, where there's a certain amount going one direction, and a certain amount going, and there's certainly one that's dominating, but that dominance is not so severe that price becomes crazy. It doesn't go one direction or another very, very, very rapidly.
The chaos of cohorts.
Right. The chaos of cohorts. I like that. So you want to understand, because not everybody is going to be right. At some point, there's a truth moment where your bet is marked to market. In the contrarian view, is marked to market. And typically, markets figure it out that shortly before the reveal. So there's a lot of correction that goes on, but there's a marking to market. And in that moment is where you see returns becoming really, really interesting. So in the case where you were right, let's say you were the dominant view, let's call it consensus for argument's sake, then the contrarian view has to correct itself. So it would have been losing money all along the way because you were dominating price. Price was moving against their view. Contrarians look at you and they say, oh my goodness, you were right. They switch directions and they match your position. You would get an extra bump at the end of the day. Returns would go your way. And so what you would see for Trey, what you would see for your portfolio, if you were betting or your stock position, but you could extrapolate to portfolio of these, you would see a slow diffusion of returns heading your way. You'd have a nice sort of ramp up in returns, and then followed by, once the information is revealed, maybe some slight bump, still some post-announcement drift. The person who's betting against you, of course, would lose all along the way. Terrible. But on the other hand, maybe I was right and Trey was wrong. Even though, and you dominated your price returns up until just before announcement, you would say, oh my goodness, I need to switch my position. You would flip your position to match mine. And in that flipping, you would move all your price, all your dollars towards my position and change the path of return. So for me, as a contrarian investor, I would have been losing money. And then as you pushed and you realized that you needed to switch, my returns would have shot up. And then again, a post-announcement drift where I would have had a decay. Now, what's really cool about this is we've just described to you the return signature of two of the factors that we talked to you about earlier, which was momentum and value. So as a consensus being right, you would have seen in the impact of price, people following your view and piling in. At the very end, contrarians would have realized you were right. You would have had an extra bump and then a decay. This is like a very nice momentum-shaped pattern. Conversely, when contrarians are right, you see this negative return followed by a pop in return space and a decay. That's a value signature. And so we made full circle. We came back and we said, oh my goodness, this idea of surprise, we've already evidenced in different quantitative investing strategies. One is value and one is momentum. These represent different cohorts in the market betting differently. And yet there's a convergence at the end. Now, the idea is we can measure both of them and have a better forecast in the future. We can arbitrage both sets of cohorts. And so you end up with a beautifully diversified set of return streams based on who you're arbitraging, who you're trying to bet against. And the probability is in a cross-sectional sense, you're getting it right in multiple dimensions.
When I hear you talk about that, what's happening for me is just this resolving to buying and holding, because, you know, I think so often we're not really thinking about the cohorts in play. Yeah. And a lot of people are just thinking, hey, it's zero sum, it's right or wrong, it's me and this guy on the other end or gal on the other end, and this is the trade. But we're all sitting around the same poker table, but we're not. one person's playing poker, the other person's playing craps, the other person's, you know, it's just like there's this wash or this pool of different people with different time horizons with different strategies that is creating so much noise that just makes me want to sit back and say, look, this is why I don't want to look at my screen for 10 years.
That's right. In which case, you know, in that sense, you're just buying the equity risk premium, just buying an index fund allows you to coast along with all that noise and ignore it and just get the value of being long an equity with a group of equities, which are likely to go up over time.
So that kind of sounds like a robo-advisor to some degree, but robo-advisors, though, they're just looking at your age and your time horizon and your risk tolerance, et cetera, and they just say, okay, here's your package. It's not very active beyond that, as I understand it. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So the activity is in what's the weight of, you know, fixed income versus equities or commodities or whatever yet. That's their active bet. The big addition for institutional investors in particular is that they're looking to increase the beyond the asset allocation. They're looking to increase their return because they have obligations. They have, like Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, it has obligations in the future. So being able to increase beyond just passive exposure to or semi-passive exposure to equity or to risk premium provides some extra juice to help cushion the blow that they're going to have in terms of meeting their obligations. In fact, when you go to a pure long short portfolio, you're not even really, it doesn't really even matter that you're in equities or fixed income or commodities, not in the sense that you still need to do security selection. You have to understand the underlying system that you're working in, but really you're not trying to harness the risk premium within those asset classes. You're really just betting one risk. It could be anything, right? You don't really care as long as you're right, right? As long as you're getting those bets and the numbers of times at the table is large.
But what's so enticing about this approach is, you know, the only other reference point I kind of have on it that comes to mind is Jim Simons and his fund. And you hear about these outsized returns that are just in like 60% plus a year for 20 years. So it's really enticing and it draws you in. But as I understand it, that approach also had limitations, or at least they found some sort of optimized scale that said, you know, look, we're only going to run a fund of this size and we're not letting in any more money. So talk to us, is that a limiting factor? Do we hit a ceiling with the approach that you're describing as well?
Yeah, so I think actually any investment approach will hit a ceiling. So there's only so much you can move around in markets before you move the market. And that then you know that you've lost whatever edge you're going to have. So the bigger you get, the less nimble you are in terms of being able to express your positions without people being able to follow you or front run you. So Rentec, they hit a limit, and so they capped out the amount of capital they could go in. To be fair to Rentec, you know, I mean, they certainly invested a lot of time, energy, and money into building machinery, working with data. It's very expensive. It's only natural that at some point they have to close and to maintain the returns that they're trying to and be able to compensate themselves for the amount of effort they put into that. That's true with any strategy. Fundamental strategies as well, right? They'll reach a capacity, albeit if they're working in large cap space because of liquidity, they'll reach it later than say a quant who's potentially operating at smaller scale or in smaller stocks than they are exclusively. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. When you were talking about machine learning, one other question that came to my mind was around the inputs and comparing it or juxtaposing it with the robo-advisor approach. This machine learning approach sounds much more complex and nuanced. And I'm wondering is it capturing headlines and news on certain companies? Is it incorporating all kinds of like this plethora of data from all over the world?
Yes. So we take in a ton of data. Our costs are huge for compute and data. And I'm sure it is with Rentec and Two Sigma. It's really, you know, and in some ways we could use more data. So we're always looking for other data sets because this helps inform our forecasting exercise. And I think you can't play in this without a ton of resources. Like as an individual, you could never compete at this scale for these things. It's an arms race. Perhaps there's an arms race for distance to the exchange, which is high frequency players played in for a long time. And that's sort of been tapped out, right? We don't hear about people building any more microwave towers, or maybe we are, but not as many as, you know, the Hummingbird project or whatever is not, you know, it's not the thing anymore. Prediction is the thing. That prediction is going to create a new set of constraints and arms race around data in all likelihood and around talent to do machine learning and around frameworks. As I said, how do you take all of these very powerful things and focus them on the way that has a high probability of success? We found one way, perhaps others will find others, but that process of understanding is very hard. takes many years of experience to understand how this plays out. And so it's an intimidating and daunting thing to think about if you haven't sort of grown into it over the course of 15 years of your life to sort of internalize all of this and understand it in a sort of coherence.
Well, what's coming to my mind is sort of like DeepMind's AlphaGo example. They're projecting out these probability trees, essentially, and each thread has a certain weight, I guess. And then as it proves out one position or the other, it's learning that and predicting. And I'm guessing this is not that dissimilar as far as the approach where there's laying out these probability trees, if that's the right vernacular, but
good enough.
Okay. Bear with me.
You're totally right. So I've spent some time talking with DeepMind here and there and the folks who work there and researchers and things. And yes, you're exactly right. I mean, AlphaGo is actually quite beautiful in many, many ways, almost exquisite. Yeah. Good for them. But they were able to harness a concept that we can't in the world of investing. So they can create data. So they can play many, many games. They create this adversary relationship between different cohorts, right? They can create cohorts who play one way and another way and another way. And they can force them to play each other at super high frequency and learn and learn and learn and learn. And so this is ideal for machine learning or AI. On the investing side, we just have to sit and watch paint dry, right? You just have to wait 1,000 years for more observations, for more cohorts, particularly if you're going directly for returns because the dynamics of returns themselves are so problematic. So you have to find you have to provide structure for machine learning in that context, which we haven't seen. You know, don't want to take anything from DeepMind, but in the context where you have limited observations, it's a very, very hard game. But you're exactly right. We are looking at probabilities. We're not looking with certainty. And so that's how our portfolios evolve, is that we look to the future at various horizons, and we say the probabilities are changing at various horizons, because you can imagine companies being successful in the short term and not in the long term, vice versa. And so we're playing this probabilistic system and letting our ideas sort of flow into portfolios that try to capture these through time. And it's quite complicated.
Well, to add to the complexity, you also have our own government now creating more and more liquidity to enter the markets in really unforeseen ways. And so I'm wondering, how does the computer accommodate for that sort of outlying factor?
So for instance, Robinhood, they created a whole different world for retail investors. It's a free trader and lots of access to leverage. But remember, those are cohorts. You know, there already were cohorts. There's hedge funds, there are mutual funds, there are ETFs, there are flows. And now we just have another one, which is very, very strong. So if you try to imagine there's a cohort of, you know, one cohort, which is, we're simplifying it, but one cohort of retail investors, where would they line up on these expectations of future events? And if you're better than they are, then obviously they're arbitrageable. I think the deeper question is, will retail look more and more like GameStop shenanigans, or will it look like fundamental investors? Will it look like, so where will they end up, and how will they impact prices? Because if they end up in a GameStop sort of situation where fundamentals don't matter, then it's problematic for our strategy. It doesn't mean that it's impossible for us to work one, but if they dominate the market over all horizons, then that's a problem. What I would hypothesize is what we've seen so far is that's a short horizon thing again, right? So this idea that voting machine, weighing machine, we're seeing a big impact on the voting side of the equation through retail flow. Will that stay that way? I don't know. Interesting to watch. But again, they're a cohort. We can look at what they do.
Now talk a little bit about your strategy, because now you have created your own firms, Delphia, and you've implemented the strategy. Is it meeting your expectations?
Yes, it's meeting our expectations because we're seasoned at this. We look at our back tests, we look at our thesis, and we say, this is what we think we should expect out of Sample going forward as we invest. And we've met those and have been quite delighted that we haven't run into the things that we know are out there. So even when you look at a back test, there are certain conditions in the world where every strategy is likely to, maybe not at the same time, but every strategy has a weakness. And the way I look at it, it's like, we've had a nice 9-month run. We know there are bad states of the world out there. None of them have shown up in that 9 months. You know, we know they're there. It's kind of like some horrible venomous spider running around. You can step on it any time, but it hasn't happened yet. And so we're quite happy. It's been a joy to watch that.
You know, I'm tempted to ask you about, as you were kind of entering into the finance space, what books and resources really inspired you. Most people default to, like, you know, Intelligent Investor, Security Analysis. But with you, I'm like, it's probably Moneyball or something that, like, you know, but what resources have made, like, the biggest impact on you that maybe others can at least grab for themselves?
By the way, the Moneyball is hilarious. So we call this process of trying to understand what moves markets, we call it Moneyball, obviously. It has a nice ring to it, right? Yeah. So there are two books which I look at as foundational for me, and I have my team read them, obviously. So one is Active Portfolio Management by Richard Gold and Ron Kahn, which doesn't tell you anything about, you know, forecasting the actual returns, but it tells you about all about portfolio construction. So assume you have some forecasts. How do you put portfolios together? And this book was seminal in the field and continues to be sort of the Bible or the rock on which fundamental investing, quantitative investing, is built upon. The other one, surprisingly, is John Cochrane has a book called Asset Pricing, which talks about, in a very generalized and quite beautiful framework, how anything can be priced, whether it's a pair of tennis shoes or wine or equities or fixed income instruments. So again, hopefully you can see the connectivity, you know, that view of the world is very aligned with me now and our team and our investing style, but in the context, again, of the Active Portfolio Management book, which is this portfolio construction handbook.
Now, is your strategy only available to institutions, or what does the outside capital look like?
So we have two sets of strategies. One set is available to institutional investors. Another strategy has just become recently available for retail. The reason you have to create separate strategies is the legal requirements for investing with institutions are very different than for retail. And so I'd love to be able to say that we can take exactly what we do for institutional investors and give it to retail, but the law will allow you to do that. Perhaps there's been some evolution in the last year in SEC regulations, so perhaps there are some things you can do, a closer approximation to what you can do for institutions. I would say the biggest difference is that one uses leverage, is pure long short. That seems to be suitable for institutional investors who can handle that kind of approach. And then if you go to the other side, you think about long only or lightly levered products that are available for retail. But as I said, things are evolving, so perhaps there's some way to make one available for the other. In the U.S., the retail side is only available in the U.S. The institutional side is available to anyone in the world.
Very cool. Well, Jonathan, this has been a real pleasure and really enlightening. I would love to do this again sometime soon, but before I let you go, I definitely want to give you the opportunity to hand off to the listeners where they can learn more about you and your research at Delphia and anything else you want to share.
We have a website, delphia.com. We'll be creating an institutional website as well in the near future. There'll be papers that we think are thought processes, primarily on the institutional side. There's always some interesting tidbits about our thesis on the retail side. I would say just look forward to, we're just getting started. We're only 9 months in. I'll be talking to folks in different channels shortly in the near future. Thank you for having me. I mean, this is very cool. You have a great podcast. You've had some really incredible people on here. It's an honor to spend an hour with you.
Well, I appreciate it. Let's do it again soon.
All right.
All right, everyone. If you're loving the show, don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast app. And remember that we always love to hear your feedback. You can always reach me on Twitter at Trey Lockerbie. And if you're just starting out, go ahead and Google TIP Finance. You can find all the courses and resources we've built for you there. And with that, we will see you again next time.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to subscribe to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network and learn how to achieve financial independence. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.